That's what she said.
That's what she said.
That's what she said.
That's what she said. Well, that's what she said.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the latest edition of That's What She Said with Sarah Spain. I am Sarah Spain. Hope you had a great Thanksgiving last week and you are getting pumped for the holiday season. I have been bouncing around since Thanksgiving, headed to University of Michigan for my final fantasy tailgate. You can head to ESPNW.com/collegefootballbachelorette to hear about my trip to Ann Arbor. And coming very soon will be my decision, my final choice for my one true college football love. I am choosing between Wisconsin, Ohio State, and Michigan. So keep your eyes and ears out for that big announcement. I've got some surprises up my sleeve. You may be surprised to hear what happens. After that, I went to Foxborough and hung out with Gronk for a couple days for a feature I'm doing on him. I'm back in Bristol to do First Take with my new radio host, Jason Fitz. We'll be debuting our show, Spain and Fitz, weeknights from 6 to 9 Eastern, starting January 2nd. So that'll be your first look at me and Fitz together doing a little hot taken on First Take. Been busy running around, but I was happy to get a chance to talk to my colleague Lewis Riddick for this podcast today. And I wanted to also remind anybody, if you are finding this and listening to this on ESPN app, iTunes, whatever, the reason you are just seeing it now, a week later, is because until the end of the year, my podcasts are on the TuneIn app exclusively for the first week, and then they go to the ESPN app, iTunes, podcast app, all that stuff. So if you have found this on TuneIn, you are on the right track. This is where you're going to find stuff for the first week, and then after a week, it heads over to the iTunes, the podcast app, all that stuff. So Lewis Riddick, I have talked to him on the radio, talked to him on TV, hung out with him in person a couple times, but hadn't ever really gotten too into his path from the NFL to working as a scout and director of pro personnel for a couple teams and then becoming a front office insider for ESPN. But I have long admired his work and his approach to the work, and man, did I love talking to him. He is basically a walking motivational poster. If you ever want to show up to work and not put in the work, not put in the preparation, and still feel good about yourself, do not listen to this, because he will shame you with his own habits into feeling bad about not giving it 185%. I also recommended he do some yoga, because all of that preparation and hard work and positive attitude maybe has him a little too riled up. But it's a great conversation, great stories about his time in the NFL and afterwards, and what he expects from himself. He treats his job in the media like he's a player, competing with people and not letting people slack. So it's a great podcast, great conversation. Excited for you guys to hear it. Here it is, my talk with Lewis Riddick.
That's what she said.
Season 2 of 30 for 30 Podcasts is now available on the ESPN app and Apple Podcasts. Episode 3, The Lights of Wrigleyville, tells the story of the decades-long wait to bring night baseball to Wrigley Field. It was a battle pitting the giant Tribune Media Company against the scrappy local residents who both loved baseball and feared the chaos that nighttime games could bring to their neighborhood. Featuring interviews with former Cub Rick Sutcliffe, Beth Murphy, owner of Murphy's Bleachers Bar, and Mike Quigley, U.S. Representative for Illinois' 5th District. Listen to 30 for 30 Podcasts today on the ESPN app and Apple Podcasts.
That's what she said.
Happy to welcome in Lewis Riddick, former ninth-round draft pick for the Niners, played 7 NFL seasons at safety, went on as a pro scout and director of pro personnel for the Redskins and Eagles, and then joined ESPN in 2013. I was going to try to list off all of your ESPN gigs, but it'd probably be easier to say the things you don't do. you are basically on anything involving the NFL.
Yeah, it seems like it, doesn't it?
Right.
I guess that's a good thing. Yeah, it's been... It's been kind of a crazy ride, Sarah. I mean, it's been fun. I've been very fortunate. The draft, without a doubt, has been the highlight of my career. A couple of years ago, being able to get on the day one coverage out of Chicago, and everything's been up and away since then. So I'm very fortunate, looking forward to whatever's coming next.
Yeah, we hear and see you everywhere, notably on the draft, also oftentimes hanging out with SVP on SportsCenter, serving as an analyst on NFL Matchup, Sunday Night Countdown, Monday Night Countdown. We've got it all. If it's NFL related, you've probably heard Lewis Riddick. And before we get into that sort of media side of your career, I want to talk about how you got into football in the first place. As a kid, did you always want to be a football player?
Yeah, I come from a big-time football family. My older brother, Rob, played 10 years in the NFL for the Buffalo Bills. I have two first cousins who played in the NFL. Their mother and my mother were sisters. So one of them was Tim Lewis, who was a first-round pick of the Packers in 1983, 11th pick overall. And then his older brother, Will, was a free agent with the Seattle Seahawks in 1980, played with the Chiefs for a year, played in the CFL for a few years. So I was going to pro football games when I was 9 years old, 10 years old, you know, and whenever we had, like, little career day type things in school, and teachers would go, okay, you know, today we're going to talk about what you want to be when you grow up. My answer was always a little different. It was always, I want to play pro football, and people right. would kind of laugh and go, yeah, right. Like, well, listen, I mean, my brother's doing it, so why right. can't I do it?
Right.
And,
yeah, you guys are
so
the less.
It was always like that for me.
Yeah, you guys are the less publicized role family, I guess. You guys all needed to have the same name for it to be more notable,
yeah,
I guess.
Yeah, no kidding. But no, it's always been a lifelong goal to be involved in football some way, somehow.
Would you say then you attribute to the athletic gene, the reason for all of this football success to your mother and her sister, or are we going to give some credit to any dads around here?
Yeah. My dad played baseball when he was younger. God bless his soul. He passed away about 11 years ago. But he was very, very instrumental in my career. A guy who had tremendous upper body strength. I mean, he was one of those guys who was just mentally very tough. He tried to pass that on to me. But, yeah, I think on my mom's side, there's no question that there were some athletic genes that were passed on that way. And it was always looked at as something as it was just a part of our life, Sarah. It really wasn't anything – it wasn't anything out of the ordinary or anything that was overemphasized. It was just kind of like what we did. And I think that's probably the key to success with whatever you do. You don't force it. It just kind of comes to you. And sports just always came to my family pretty easy.
Yeah. Did you play other sports growing up?
Yeah. You know, I played baseball when I was younger for a couple of years until I got pegged in the ribs one time batting. And I wasn't about to stand in there and take shots like that anymore, especially when kids started throwing curveballs and stuff. I was done with that.
But you're playing football, dude. Come on.
Yeah, I know, but you know what? Baseball.
You like the pads.
Different.
Yeah.
I couldn't take it. My dad used to get so frustrated because I'd back out of the batter's box anytime the ball looked anywhere close to me.
That's funny.
And I ran track all through high school. As a matter of fact, I was a pretty good hurdler. I was nationally ranked in high school until I tore a hamstring pretty good when I was a senior. Mm. But, I think football and track were really my two loves. And then came all football once I got to college.
Yeah, so were you recruited for track as well? Was that ever a thought in your mind that you'd do both?
Yeah, you know, before, when I was going into my senior year in high school, I really wanted to do both when I went to the University of Pittsburgh, because at the time, a guy named Roger Kingdom was, like, I believe he was the world record holder in the 110-meter high hurdles at the time, and he was a guy who trained at Pitt still, and I wanted to do both, and I won the state championship in Pennsylvania indoors when I was a senior in high school, and then when the outdoor season came around is when I tore my hamstring. So I kind of scrapped the whole dual sport thing. But I wanted to, but an hamstring's never, I mean, geez, 30 years later, it's still not the same as it used to be. So that kind of killed my dual sport dreams.
Yeah. I'll take this opportunity to announce that the women's hurdles do not change their height from junior high to college, which is a real problem and should be remedied. And it was especially problematic for yours truly, who was a very tall hurdler and would have done much better and even better had they gone up at every level like they do on the men's side.
And
rant. Okay. So you get to Pittsburgh. Were there expectations? Was there a point in your career, either in high school or Pittsburgh, where you thought that the childhood dreams and the family dreams of the NFL were maybe a little bit out of touch, or were you always on that track and believed to be good enough that you could make it?
Yeah, you know what? Things were always looking up and up and up. I mean, my first 3 years in school, my freshman, sophomore, junior year, everything improved to the point where between my junior and senior year in college, you know, when all the preseason All-American teams came out and draft projections came out, it's not like it is now, but it was sporting news would always come out with something at that time. And I mean, I was considered a top 15 prospect going into my senior year. So I'm thinking everything is great. And I had a absolutely terrible senior year, let's just put it that way, where it started off good and then things kind of snowballed and I kind of got inside my own head and things just weren't as – didn't go as well in the second half of the year.
You were a captain, right?
I'm sorry?
You were a captain, but...
Yeah, it sure was.
Yeah.
I mean, everything was looking great until like halfway through the season. And And then, you know, you wind up pressing, you wind up trying to do different things to kind of get yourself back on track instead of just kind of reverting back to maybe what got you there in the first place. And then I didn't do very well at the combine. I ran a slow time. And so what wound up happening, I got drafted in the ninth round, which would be a free agent. Now you wouldn't even get drafted in today's game. I went to 49ers. They had a great team at the time. So Joe Montana was out there. Steve Young was out there. Jerry Rice was in his prime. So I got cut from that football team. And then for a while there, sir, I didn't really know how my football career was going to turn out, to be honest with you. I didn't play that fall in 1991 at all. And what wound up happening was the World League of American Football was in existence then. And a guy named Jim Haslett, who was the head coach of the Saints for a while, defensive coordinator for the Redskins for a while, head coach of the Rams for a little bit, he was coaching in the World League. And he knew my brother because they played together for the Bills in the early 80s. And he called me and he said, look, get your behind in shape. I'm going to draft you into this World League. We're going to get you back in the league. And you're going to thank me one day for saving your rear end. And that's exactly what happened. I played for the Sacramento Surge in 92 in the World League and then signed with the Atlanta Falcons after that. And then everything kind of got back on track. So, but there was a minute there for sure where I thought, here I am trying to surpass my relatives at every stage. And I had kind of topped them at every stage as far as my high school career, college career, until my senior year. And I thought everything had just fallen apart. So I kind of, for a minute there, I thought I was going to wilt and not really respond to the adversity the way I should. But I kind of got myself back on track. And it's something that I try to tell others about, that, hey, I've been flat on my back. I've been to the point where I thought football was over for me and I didn't really know what I was going to do. But if you really care about it and you really want it, you'll find a way. And I found a way with the help of others.
Right. So you end up with the Falcons, a couple years with the Browns, back to the Falcons, to the Raiders, and then end with the Orlando Rage. Is that in the
– How about that?
Where? What league is that?
That was the old XFL.
Oh, nice.
How about that? So Galen Hall was the head coach there, and I was kind of done with my NFL career. XFL was just coming into existence. I thought it would be fun to do. And Galen Hall was the head coach. He was the old ex-Florida Gators coach. And Galen had recruited me pretty hard when I was in high school. So I kind of had a relationship there, played there for a year, and then just kind of didn't do anything. Just was wondering how I wanted to transition from there into, you know, kind of your post-career life. A couple of people had called me and asked me about personnel work. And I was like, man, I don't want to be a scout. I don't want to be front office. I hated you guys when I was a player because all you guys were trying to do was get rid of me. And the Green Bay Packers, a guy named Ken Harrock had asked me. He was a front office guy up there. He had asked me at one point. I was like, nah, Green Bay, no, no thanks. I was living in Atlanta at the time. And then John Schneider and Marty Schottenheimer had linked up in Washington in 2001. Schneider was like, look, I'm not going to take no for an answer. Just let me fly you up here to D.C. and let me talk to you about being a scout. You're a smart guy. You've had a career that's kind of been all over the place, so you kind of know what it's like to be on top and what it's like to be on the bottom, what it's like to recover. That's exactly what you – that's the kind of experience that can help you in personnel work. So I went up there, talked to him. Next thing you know, I'm in personnel.
So, you know, you mentioned that he said you were a smart guy. Is that something that you kind of wore as a badge throughout your NFL career? Was it clear to others in the locker room and on the team that you were one of the leaders when it comes to knowing the game?
Yeah, I mean, that's really what, you know, I guess the team the most that I identify with in my career from a football learning standpoint is my time in Cleveland, being with Bill Belichick and Nick Saban at the same time. And the one thing that those two guys, above all else, demand is football intelligence and football intellect. Like, they don't put up with errors in any way, shape, or form. So if you're going to play for them, you're going to have two things. You're going to have that football intelligence, and you better be tough as hell because they'll get rid of you if you don't. And I just talked with Bill about two or three months ago. I went up there for SportsCenter to watch their training camp. And that was one of the things he said. He said, you know, the thing I respected about you the most was that you were smart. You could tell you something one time, and you didn't forget it, and you were tough. And I respect that more than anything. And that meant a lot to me, coming from him after all these years. And Nick used to tell me the same thing. So that's always been something that I knew at some point in time would serve me well with whatever I was going to do after actually playing the game, as I knew I had a decent head on my shoulders that I'd be able to do something where critical thinking would help me out.
You know, some of the smarter guys are the ones who have become outspoken about concussions and CTE. You know, Hunter Hillenmeyer in Chicago retired and said it was directly because of that. There was a whole rash of Niners guys, including some that said, you know, it just wasn't worth it to them. When you look back at how inevitable it felt to you to play football and to become a football player, how do you think that that might be different if everything else was the same, but you were dropped into the world now instead of when you grew up?
Yeah, you know, I mean, obviously knowledge is power, right? And you kind of know that there's real risk to playing the game now. Not that there wasn't then, but obviously you're aware of it now. But I've given a lot of thought to that, about would it have changed my outlook and my willingness to really sacrifice in the way that maybe people sacrificed back then at all costs to play the game for much less money. And I'll be honest with you, I'm not trying to be Johnny Tough Guy. I'm not trying to be something that I'm not. But the truth of the matter is, I think I would still play because the game offered obviously a way out of maybe the living conditions that my family was in when we were younger. I mean, it was a way to kind of like improve your socioeconomic status and improve your quality of life, which was very important to me. Number two, I mean, I really football from a young age, even if my brothers and my cousins hadn't played it, it was just something that I was always attracted to, the physicality of the sport and just the one-on-one matchups within the team concept of the sport. And I just didn't, I deemed the risk as being acceptable. And I think I would still do the same, although I would probably play the game differently now than I did then. In the early 90s, when I played, I mean, these were the days of Ronnie Lott, Dennis Smith, Steve Atwater. I grew up watching guys like Jack Tatum, Lawrence Taylor. I mean, and the game was, I mean, it was vicious, vicious, vicious. And we gave it out vicious. And when you got it on the other end, on the receiving end, you accepted it. And I think that would the respect for your health would have been different if I had been playing now. But there's still no question that I would have played. It's a beautiful game that obviously has risks involved in it. But I would still want to play it again because of the things that it taught me for life in general and the things that it gave me and my family and life overall, and it's still given to us now.
Right. Do you find yourself feeling at all when you watch now? You know, there's a lot of former players who will complain about the changing rules. Do you find yourself having trouble explaining away why they're necessary to the point where, you know, you feel the urge to defend the old way, but you can't?
Yeah, that's a great way of putting it. But, you know, you would like to see the game kind of have some of the same characteristics that it's had in the past because, look, to play football, you have to be a little bit different anyway. And to really play it at the professional level and be willing to accept what comes along with it in terms of injury risk, you have to be a little different. You have to be maybe not wired right to some degree. And you miss some of that to understand why now that you need to take the precautions that you do. So you have to kind of support the way the league is moving as far as trying to protect players from head trauma. What's interesting is that some of the vicious lower body shots that you see defensive players put on offensive players now would have absolutely been grounds for an all-out brawl when I was playing.
Right.
You would have had guys taking helmets off and fighting all the way out into the street if you would have got hit the way guys are hitting now. And that's one of the weird things to me. But, I mean, I get it. I get it, and I accept it. And you have to recondition yourself as to what the game means now and how it's played now and how it's officiated now. But I still every once in a while will, like, watch some of the old clips from back in the days when I was playing and watch the guys like Lawrence Taylor and Mike Singletary and Ronnie Lott because those were my heroes, and they'll always be my heroes.
Yeah. So you finish your career in the XFL and you get roped into being on the team side. Did you enjoy it once you got into scouting?
Yeah, it was. I did. I mean, and there were. I wasn't one of those guys who tried to continue to live in the past and have the player's mentality. I used my experience as a player to kind of help me transition into being a front office type. I really tried to be as good as I possibly could be at taking what I knew about the game and being able to organize my thoughts, put it on paper so it had value in the scouting world. I used my experiences as a player and my relationships with players to help me just be a better front office person. I was able to, I think, give some insight into player thinking and player mentality and team building and locker room mentality and what guys were really looking for and needed for success. I tried to use all of that to help me be a better front office guy. I never tried to take sides. When I thought players sucked, I said that they sucked. If I thought they were good, I said that they were good. When players used to come up to me and ask me, you know, hey, do you think our coaches stink, or do you think I should be playing more? If I didn't think they did, I'd be like, no, I don't. I don't think you're very good. I don't think you're fast enough. I don't think you're this or what. So I tried to play it as straight as I could and as honest as I could, and just use everything that I had been taught. Because I had been coached by guys who were brutally honest, and
yeah,
there were times when I hated Nick and I hated Bill, and because they hurt my ego in some ways where I thought I was better than maybe I was. But I understood it once I got out of the game that that's what makes those guys great, is that they don't sugarcoat anything. And that's how I tried to become as a front office person, and that's definitely how I try to be now on TV. If you're good, I'll say it, and if you don't, I'll say the same thing. And I think people ultimately, Sarah, people respect that.
Yeah, I want to get into that in a little bit, but I want to find out how you got to the media side in the first place. There was a gap of a couple years. Yeah, there's a gap of a couple years between you ending your time as the, I believe, pro personnel director for the Eagles,
a director
of pro personnel. And then it took you a couple years before you got to ESPN, right?
No, actually it happened within a matter of months. It just kind of,
oh, really?
It did. I left Philadelphia in, I guess that would be the summer of 2013. And now there was a couple months there where I wasn't sure if I was going to like really give up on or just veer away from being in the front office and what I really wanted to do. Did I want to get into coaching? Did I want to get into some other field, maybe agent representation? But TV had always been in the back of my mind because I did some TV stuff when I was with the Redskins in the front office with their in-house TV station. So that was always something that I considered. How I came upon ESPN is kind of funny, really. I mean, it's totally just luck. NFL Insiders was starting at the time. Seth Markman was, and the people at ESPN were creating that show for the fall. And a cousin of mine, Will Lewis, who at the time had been working for the Seattle Seahawks, then was going to take a job with the Kansas City Chiefs when John Dorsey and Andy Reid started their time down there in 2013. He knew John Clayton, Adam Schefter, Chris Mortensen, and I guess it was John Clayton who told him, hey, look, ESPN's starting this new show. They're looking for front office people, not necessarily who played the game, but they're looking for front office people as part of the makeup of that show. Are you interested? And he said, well, I'm going to be getting back into the front office, but I do know somebody who you should talk to. And he gave them my name. And so he hooked up a conversation between Seth and myself. We talked for about maybe 15, 20 minutes. Seth said, well, I want you to come up here for the auditions. We're going to have a couple people up here to see how we're going to formulate this show. And whoever's the best at it will get the most airtime. There's no guarantees of a contract. You're going to get paid per day. I think we got paid like $800 a show was the only thing that they could guarantee. They didn't guarantee you how many shows or nothing. I was like, good, I'll do it. I went up there. We had the auditions. They started putting me on. I signed it. And that was in August of 2013. November of 2013, I signed a guaranteed contract. And then either 2014 or 15, I did another contract. And then I just signed a longer, much bigger one a couple months ago. So that's kind of how it went. I mean, it was totally luck that my cousin wasn't interested in the job because he got a job in Kansas City and just said, hey, look, why don't you talk to this guy, Seth Markman? I didn't know Seth Markman from The Man on the Moon. And it just happened that way. It just totally luck like that.
And you were done with the Eagles position
before
that. It wasn't that a choice to leave. Got it.
No.
That's crazy
no.
It happened so fast.
Yeah, it is. It is. But I knew it's always been easy for me to talk about football. Now, obviously, there's a whole lot of other things that go into TV, as you well know. But I guess I want to say this the right way. I knew there's certain things that you just know that you're going to nail. You just need the opportunity, and you just kind of need to, like, put it in the right place as far as how you're going to do it. And I knew kind of that's how it would go in TV once I got in there.
I feel like you're just like a safety, though. So you kind of probably feel that way about everything in life, right? I mean, it sounds like, and not in a bad way. I'm going to say confidence instead of cockiness. It sounds like that's a through line for you. Well, yeah, I wanted to be in the NFL, so then I was. And then I wanted to be great in college, so then I was. And then I wanted to, other than your hiccup that you had early on in your NFL career, it's just sort of been, I know I can do this. I'm good at this. Now I'm just going to go do it.
Yeah, you know, I think what that confidence comes from, Sarah, is the fact that I'm willing to do whatever it takes, no matter what it is. So I don't ever, you know, there's a lot of people, you know this. I mean, you've run into it. You're a successful professional. So you know that there are many people who talk a big game about what they want, but they're not really willing to make the sacrifice to really get what they want.
Yep.
And for me, it's always been, I'll go above and beyond to where people sit there and shake their head and go, man, you need to lighten up. You need to chill out about what you're trying to do because that's not normal. And it's just like, well, I don't really know any other way. And I would say it's probably really ramped up ever since I didn't get drafted where I wanted to. And then when I got cut from San Francisco, it was a total, total slap in the face. And it was embarrassing in many, many ways that everything had come so easy for me. My family had been in the pros. I was just every step of the way, I'm one-upping my cousins, one-upping them. I'm like, damn, this is easy. This is how it is. And then, wham, you're flat on your back. You're sitting at home watching NFL games, and you're going, I'm totally out of it.
Yeah.
I'm nobody. I have no identity. I'm not associated with the team. I'm just like everybody else. And I hated that feeling to the point of, like, almost insanity. I hated that feeling of being insignificant. I hated it. I couldn't deal with it. And I'll never let that happen again.
Looking back, do you think that you didn't put in enough work or that you were taking things for granted? Or do you think you were working as hard as you could and it just wasn't your time yet?
I think it's a little bit of the latter. I just think that what I wound up seeing is, you know, closer you get to the top of what you want, and you get the closer you get to the, like, the pinnacle, the best of the best, the better everyone else is, and you kind of really need to either train smarter, prepare smarter, be more consistent with what you do. You can't have the ups and downs and get away with it. You have to be on it all the time. And, you know, Bill taught me that when I was in Cleveland. And he used to say all the time, I can get anybody off the street to do it some of the time. I need people who can do it all of the time.
Right.
And that's the difference between being on the bench, being on the street, or being a backup or being a starter, is the people who can do it all the time. That's life, right? I mean, the people who are the most successful, unless you just had an inheritance or hit the lottery or something, it's usually the people who are the best of the best, getting paid the most, getting the most attention and all that, or the people who do it good all the time.
Yeah.
And that requires a special kind of focus and dedication. I don't care what the profession is. I don't care if it's movies, TV, doctors, whatever it is, you have to be willing to sacrifice to do it good all the time. And that's kind of how I recalibrated my mind to go, that's just how it has to be. So when I got into TV, it wasn't, hey, this is easy, I'm just going to show up and talk about something I've done my whole life. I prepare my ass off as if I don't know anything about the game. And I think it shows. So, and I'll never change that.
I remember hearing a podcast, I think it was with Jay Williams, who really started to approach his career in the media almost in the same way he approached his sport. It was not, it needed to be very regulated and it needed to be very systematic in order for him to do it the way he thought he needed to improve.
Yeah.
Did you feel like you approached it as if it was a sport or was it just I'm going to pick up and learn as I go and like suck onto as much information as I can?
No, you know what? I very much so approached TV, and I approach it now really almost the same way that I approached my front office career, which was it's very, like in the front office, you have to be very, very detailed as far as your time is concerned because there's so many things you can watch when it comes to football, and there's so much information you can learn about players that you could do it 24 hours a day and still not have enough time. And so I kind of use the same approach to going on TV now and getting ready for the draft or getting ready for the combine or getting ready for the Senior Bowl before that or the Super Bowl before that or NFL matchup. it's very regimented how I approach my weeks, how I approach every show. And the truth of the matter is, look, if you watch TV objectively, and I know you do, you can tell who's approaching it that way and who is really preparing and who isn't.
Yeah.
You can tell. Because when you can tell the people who can tell you stuff that you go, I had no idea. I never thought about that. I
right.
never looked at it that way. And you can tell when you're listening to something and you go, I could have read that online. That sounds like
right.
something I just saw on Twitter. That sounds like
yeah.
something somebody else said. And I don't want to be that. I just don't. So, you know, some people go, hey, you know, you can kind of get by without having to do it that way. Well, I don't want to get by, right? I mean, we want to stand out. You want to stand out. You want to be the best professional you could possibly be. And the only way you can do that is to do stuff that's not ordinary. And I'm telling you, that really comes from, and I tell these guys this all the time, man, but that comes from, I know that stuff started to click for me once I got back in the league and I was around guys like Saban and Belichick who are different, Sarah. I'm telling you,
yeah.
the pressure that they just keep on your neck all the time is unlike anything I've ever imagined. They almost broke me. They almost broke me to the point where I was like, I don't know if I can handle this, but that's what they want to see. And if you don't break, then they become advocates of yours. They become fans of yours because
mm-hmm.
those guys were trying to be the best of the best, and they are. Nick is the greatest college coach of all, and Bill, when he's done, will be the greatest pro coach of all time. And why not me? Why not you? Why not try to be the best of all time in whatever you're doing? And that's
yeah.
how I approach TV. It's really that simple. And I know some people will let me listen to this and go, oh, man, come on, man. You know, knock it off. Those guys are just different. Actually, yeah, they're real smart guys, but their dedication is ridiculous. And not everybody has that. They just don't. No, not everybody wants to make that choice. And I just decided I'm going to make the choice and see what happens.
Yeah. You know, Richard Deitch wrote a piece about you in August and said you were the best on-air NFL hire ESPN has made this decade. And I wonder, there are, I guess, moments where you need to ease your way into some place, and then there are moments where it's okay to come boldly in. When you're
yeah.
working with guys who have been in the industry for a long time and they respect your mm-hmm. knowledge and they respect your playing, but they have their own history of playing and their own history of the media, do you need to ever rein it in, or have you felt like as long as you were doing good work, people were okay with you perhaps hedging in on their time, their space, their opportunities?
Yeah, I was – That's a great question. And look, I knew this. I knew that in TV, there were plenty of guys who got crazy opportunities and got put on the biggest shows and all simply because of what they did in their playing career. And it happens to this day, and it'll probably, to a large degree, always be that way. I didn't care. I wasn't disrespectful. I mean, a lot of these guys were guys who I had played against maybe, or guys who I had watched and respected the heck out of them as far as what they did on the football field. But I was like this. I looked at it this way when I came in. We're not playing anymore. We're not
right.
running a 40 anymore. I'm not trying to defend you as a safety anymore. I'm not trying to tackle you as a running back. I'm not trying to compete against you for playing time as a fellow defensive back or whatever position you played. Now it's about how good are you at taking what you know and telling people who are watching on TV what you know in a way that they sit there and they go, I want to hear more of this guy. I want to hear more of this guy. I want to hear more of this guy. Give me more of what he's telling me. And what I did was, I didn't try and one-up anybody. I was never disrespectful. But I knew this. When we were on, if you didn't prepare like I was going to prepare, then it was going to show.
Yeah.
And I didn't care. And I wasn't trying to dumb anything down. I wasn't going to try and gloss anything over. I wasn't going to try and be something that I'm not. And I just went 1,000 miles an hour with that kind of approach. So far, so good.
Yeah, because I think there is this idea of respecting a lot of guys for what they did before, but this is a whole new game. This is
Absolutely.
A whole new career, and they don't get to be better or beat you because of what came in that last career. Because,
That's right.
Listen, I've watched plenty of panels of people who I would love to see back on the football field, but I do not really care about hearing when they're talking about it.
Right.
We saw that in the one Super Bowl when the lights went out and everyone just sat there and stared. And you were like, can we get someone who's just a TV person to step in? Because this is awful to watch, right?
Yeah.
And I think you're right. There's this sweet spot of guys who were great at the game and great at talking about it. And I would much rather watch someone who's got some experience, but maybe wasn't quite as good, that's much better at articulating and explaining and educating after they're done.
Absolutely. You know, two stories I'll tell you. One, Jerry Madelon, who used to work for us, and you know him.
Yeah.
He, one of the things that stick with me the most that he told me was, remember this, in this order, this is what you are, I think you should be doing on TV and all people should be doing. Inform the people who are watching you first and foremost. Educate them about something that maybe they didn't know before so they feel smarter when they're done listening to you. And lastly, entertain them. Do it in that order. Don't get it twisted around. Don't think you have to be out there and be a showman first and entertain people and then somewhere along the way maybe give them some information about something that they can use. Because at some point in time, You're not out there to just, you know, you're not out there to put on a show. You're out there to give people analysis about what you're an expert in. That's what you're there for. So remember that. And it's one of the things that I've tried to take into every show that I go on. And I've tried to, like, look, I'm kind of a serious person by nature. So sometimes I can almost be too serious. And I know as I've gotten more comfortable and I've kind of tried to relax a little bit more into my role, that you'll see a little bit more of my off-camera personality come out. But I've always taken that advice to heart, and I approach it that way. So if your style is different than that, then it's very much so going to contrast. It's going to very much look different if you're sitting next to me and your deal is much more to kind of like be a jokester or be funny and try and just make everybody laugh, but you're not giving them much information. It's going to look totally different than what my style is. So I think if I'm watching TV, if I'm watching football, if I'm watching basketball, whatever it is, I want you to tell me something about the game that I can go, yeah, man, now I know a little bit more about that sport. Now and then if you're funny along the way, then I'm really going to dial into you. But if you're just smoking mirrors and you're just yelling and not really giving me anything I can latch on to, I'm going to tune you out fast. So I kind of try and approach what I do the same way. And those are the people I gravitate towards when I'm watching it, whether it be football or otherwise.
You mentioned earlier, you always tell it like it is. Did you have to decide consciously when you started your career in the media whether to protect teammates, players, friends, coaches that you love, or tell it like it is? Or is that something that you still sometimes pick and choose?
Yeah, one of the things I told Seth Markman when I got hired and I signed my first contract was, look, you're never going to get the impression that I'm just angling to get back into the league. And I've watched I could count on both hands the number of times I've turned people on, and I know I'm sitting there going, you're just trying to get back in the league because you won't tell like it is with anybody. And you'll sit here and give this milquetoast answers about everything. I promise you won't see that. Now, there's obviously people in the league who I'm closer to than others, and there's people who you'll be like, man, you're kind of like very supportive of that guy. But at the same time, look, I have close friends in the league who I've been very critical of. But I do it from a perspective born out of, like, kind of knowledge. I don't ever try to guess. I don't try to fill in gaps. I don't speculate. And they respect that. It's
yeah,
when
I think if you're fair, people accept it, even if you're harsh. Yeah,
that's right. And that's where I've kind of been able to get away with maybe not being always very supportive of things and maybe being a little bit more critical at some points than others. But, I'm one of those. I haven't burned any bridges. And if I have, then I probably wasn't really good friends with you in the first place. And you're just offended that I said it like it was, because I have never made up anything about anybody. I have never wildly speculated about anybody. And the truth of the matter is, and I say this with all due respect to people, I was taught by the very best that there is. And I know what I'm talking about when it comes to football. And I'm telling you, you don't have to have been one of the very best to play it to know what you're talking about as far as being able to critically analyze it. Because the two guys who were the two best of all time in college and pros, Bill never played pro, and neither did Nick. And some of the best coaches of all time weren't great Hall of Fame players. So it's not a prerequisite.
I'm sure it hasn't always been that they get it, though. Have you gotten pushback from certain teams or players?
Yeah. I mean, there's people. I'm sure there's people in the industry who. Okay. Yeah, there are players and coaches who I'm sure look at me and go, well, "Who the hell does he think he is?" I mean, what are you saying? I mean, don't be critical. But yeah, I'm sure there are. And then I know I've developed relationships with people who I didn't even know before I got into TV, and who were like, "Hey, I've watched you, man. You really know what you're talking about." And I struck up friendships that way. And then even in the industry itself, right? I mean, I'm sure there are people who are in the industry right now who were better players or had more storied careers than me, who may look at my delivery and my approach as, you know, I should be doing more than he's doing. I know more than he does, or whatever. I was a better player than he does. But you know what? Like, as you said, and as we kind of started off this part of the conversation, it doesn't matter what you did. We're not playing anymore. So this is a whole new ball game. So yeah, I'm not for everyone, Sarah. I know that, but at the same time, and I'm good with that. And I prefer it that way. I just know this: I work hard at it. I really do care about it. It's never a situation where I go on and go, you know what? Just give me a couple stats, and I'll just BS my way through it. Never approach it that way. Never will.
You mentioned that you told Seth, you know, I'm never going to look like I'm angling for a job, but you've openly talked about how you would be interested in the GM job. You interviewed for the Niners GM position. According to some sources, you interviewed for the Chiefs, which you claimed
that,
which you didn't. And you're the ultimate source, so we're sticking with you.
But
first of all, why is it that you'd like to be back in that position? And is it just GM, or is it any other gigs on the football team side?
No, I would like to, because I know I could do it. Because I know I could build a winner, because I was taught by the best. And I'll tell you what, having gotten out of personnel and looked at it, you know, kind of step back and look at the league overall, many guys who have done the same thing tell you it gives you a much different perspective. Because when you're working for a team, you're kind of tunnel vision as far as how can I help my team? How are my players on this team doing? How can we upgrade maybe this position, that position, this position? You don't really look at the trends of the league overall. You're just trying to survive from week to week and get a W for your own team. Stepping back like this, I've developed more relationships, have studied more team-building philosophies, more X and O concepts, and now I think if I went back, I would be 10 times better than I was when I was doing it before. Would it be for any other role than GM? No. I have no interest in being a scout, being a pro director, being a director of personnel. I really have no interest in doing that, because I know that I'm good enough to be a GM. I've interviewed for the position. I know what it takes to do the position. And, you know, I don't know which president it was who I think they – I don't know who. I'm not sure, but I remember hearing this quote one time where somebody asked the president, when did you know you could – or when did you believe that you could be a president? And he said, well, when I met other presidents.
Right,
and
right.
That's not to be disrespectful, but – I know I could be a GM, so if the right situation comes up, I have been upfront with Seth also about the fact that if it was for a GM job and it's for the right place and it's with people who I could work with, I'd be interested. But I'm not going to try and politic in terms of watering down my message in order not to offend anybody. Either you're going to like me and you're going to think I'm qualified, or you're not. And that way it kind of like weeds itself out anyway, right? I mean, that way I don't, there's not, people kind of, what you see is what you get with me. So if you like what I talk about on TV and how I look and how I present myself, then you're going to like me when you interview me, because I'm going to be the same way. You're not going to go, whoa, that's not how you were on TV. No, what you're seeing is what you're getting.
So let's say the GM's opportunity doesn't come up right away and it's not a perfect fit. What are your goals? Like, are you a goal setter within this industry, or are you a put your head down and work and see what comes?
No, absolutely. I mean, a goal for me, the ultimate goal for me, from a broadcasting perspective, is to call games and to call Monday Night Football. That's the ultimate for me. I grew up watching Monday Night Football, and I played for John Gruden, and I know how hard he works at doing it, and that's why he's so good at it. He prepares for Monday Night Football the way he prepared as a coach. I've seen the stuff that he puts together to call a game. I've seen the stuff he puts together when we have draft meetings prior to the draft, how he prepares to actually go on TV and talk about these players. And he's a guy who probably of anybody who does TV I respect the most, because he approaches it the same way he approached coaching. So what he's doing is probably the ultimate for me in terms of what I would want to do, is to call Monday Night Football, a sport that used to come on at 9 o'clock. I used to watch it when Howard Cosell and Frank Gifford and Don Meredith were doing it. And I used to just beg my dad if I could just stay up till halftime before I had to go to bed, because I was in elementary school. That would be the ultimate for me, Sarah, is to have Monday Night Football and have me sitting there analyzing it. That would freak me out. That would freak out everybody. I'd be like, now that's a dream realized as far as broadcasting is concerned.
Yeah, that's your new playing in the NFL goal.
That's right.
Does it drive? Are you still with? Are you still with Ira Stahlberger?
Yeah, I am, and Jim Ornstein together. Yeah, at WME.
Ira and I used to work together at Intersport when I just graduated from college, which is so funny. Does it drive them crazy that you have one job that you are working hard on and devoting your focus to, but there's this other job that's sort of off on the side that you keep an eye out for? Is that a tough balance for you?
No, not at all. Because really what I do and how I have all the things that I do to kind of come up with things to talk about on TV and give perspective on TV, it kind of is all the kind of thing that would naturally help me do or carry out the role of the GM anyway. So it kind of all goes together. They know that if the right situation came up, that I'd be all over it. And they've been very supportive of it. And they've, you know, I've talked to them about that before, that if that comes up, that's something that I'm going to be interested in. And they have no issues with that whatsoever, nor should they. I mean, because it's not like, you know, it's not like those jobs are, it's not like I'm out there beating, you know, pounding the pavement for one of them, but if the right one comes up, it's a natural thing that I think that anyone would want to do, is to try and build a pro football team, a championship caliber pro football team, especially given my background.
So you've got a couple dudes that just graduated from the NFL. They're smart guys. They're not sure whether they want to go into more the personnel team side or the media side. What do you think the biggest difference in the skill set is, if you had to tell them what they'd be good for and why they should do it?
You know, it's funny, they have the both of those careers, personnel and media, have a lot of overlapping characteristics, meaning how well can you take the knowledge that you have from playing the game at a high level and put that on paper and talk about it in a way that if people didn't have a visual image of what you're talking about, they could create one in their mind. That's what scouting is all about when you're talking about players, is if I'd never seen this guy, after I'm done talking about him, you go, I can tell you, I can see exactly what this guy must look like. And on TV, it's kind of like the same way. When you're talking about the game, if there isn't some kind of video running in the background, people can go, I know exactly what he's talking about. I can picture what he's trying to describe. And if you're able to do that, if you're willing to work at doing that, then you have a hell of a chance of being successful with it. Look, some guys are just better talkers than others, so it's always going to come out a little bit differently. It's going to sound a little bit different from guy to guy, but I think that is something that you have to be able to do. You have to be able to create images in people's heads as to what you're talking about, and it has to be very fluid and linear. You can't be all over the place, because next thing you know, people kind of get that blank look on their face.
Yeah. Yep.
What the hell are you talking about?
And, right, or your 30 seconds is over and you've been muted four times by Reali and you've been awarded no points. Yeah. You got to get your thoughts together.
Exactly.
It. Well, before I let you go, you have to do the thing that everybody does and nobody expects.
Didn't expect a kind of Spanish Inquisition. Nobody expects the Spanish Inquisition.
It's the Spanish Inquisition. Number one, what's the natural talent you wish you were gifted with?
A natural talent I wish I was gifted with, huh? Can it be anything?
Yeah.
Okay. I wish I had Michael Jordan like leaping ability, which I don't, and my brother does, and I don't.
So crazy hops.
Yes, crazy like. Windmill dunks and all that. I've just never been able to do that stuff.
That would be pretty fun. Number two, what's your desert island album? You can only have one.
One album.
Yes.
Oh,
you're stuck on a desert island for life.
I can only listen to one album, huh? Oh, boy. I'd have to really go all the way back. Maybe one of Michael Jackson's old school albums.
Yeah.
Maybe Thriller. I love Michael Jackson.
Number three, if you could switch lives with anyone for a day, who would it be?
Huh. Cristiano Ronaldo.
Interesting.
Or Lewis Hamilton, the Formula One world champion.
Yeah.
I'd love to drive a Formula One race car like that, as easy as he does it.
You're into cars like that and racing?
Yeah. I used to be big in the Formula One. I used to go to the races as much as I could.
Wow, nice. Number four, what's the most scared you've ever been?
Scared. Probably. I remember riding riding a roller coaster called Steel Force, I believe it was called, at Cedar Point in Ohio.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was called Steel Force, something like that, where it kind of went up and like out over. You could see this lake and this parking lot, and the track just seemed so little, and I literally was shaking and sweating and wouldn't look up. I thought I was going to die. I said, "This is it."
What age was this?
Oh, I was in the pros. I was 25.
Say last week. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Number five, what would you consider your biggest failure?
The NFL draft of 1991. Of not going in the first round.
Because of your senior year performance?
Yeah, because I fully expected to, and I couldn't face my family that day. I literally got in my car at home and just drove back to school. And this is the time they didn't have the internet. There was no cell phones or nothing. That was the lowest point of my life, without a doubt. I felt like I had let my mom and my dad down, and they were so upset for me. But I was just absolutely flat on my back, crushed. I didn't know what I was going to do at that point. That's, without a doubt, my biggest failure. I wish I could do it over again my senior year.
Yeah. Isn't that crazy, too, how, like, you can have success later in life, but those ones will always just sting forever, even though it all worked out?
I wish I could get over it. It still haunts me to this day. As a matter of fact, people will tell you now, you know me the best, that they just kind of, like, throw their hands up in the air and go, he'll never let that go. It'll always be the number one thing that he will never forget and he never wants to revisit again.
Yeah. Number six, what habit or quality do you think has contributed most to your success?
Resilience. I won't give up. And it's kind of like the resilience and commitment to trying to be the best. It doesn't matter what I'm doing. It doesn't matter if when I used to cut my own lawn. The lawn had to be the best. When I used to do my own flower beds at my house, it had to be the best. It's always that commitment. It's stupid. You know, it's really not a good thing. But it's what drives me. So, yeah.
Number seven, what's the thing about yourself you'd most like to improve?
My patience. Mm-hmm. My lack of patience.
You do strike me as someone who might be impatient with others.
Yeah. My lack of patience and I have kind of a quick trigger. I can get heated quick. My dad was Puerto Rican, so I think I get it from him.
Are you more impatient you're waiting in line for something, or are you more impatient with other people's stupidity, or like, where does it rear its head the most?
I'm impatient with people who I think I'm just impatient with people who aren't dedicated. Like if you do something, then do it all the way. Don't just do it to say, hey, look, if I'm average, I'm good. And you know, that'll cause friends of mine to say, dude, you need to chill. You need to relax a little bit more, maybe enjoy things a little bit more. But I'm scared to death of being ordinary.
You're like a walking motivational poster.
Yeah, well, I've been told it's going to shorten my life, so maybe I need to chill out a little bit.
Right. Do you do yoga? Do you meditate? Maybe
no,
we could pick up some
no,
sort of
need,
offsetting activity.
I need to, because even when I'm sitting there trying to do that kind of stuff, I'm thinking, don't I have something else to do?
Oh, me too. But that's why I make myself do it, though. That's why I make myself do it, because if I don't, then I'm not going to take an hour and step away from things. I have to do that. And then I can hear my head being like, what's right after this? And then in 15 minutes, and then I'll be like, stop it. Focus on what you're doing.
Yeah, I could definitely use some of that.
But you know what you got to do is like challenge someone to something in yoga or meditating, and then it will give you a goal. And then you can still use it to compete, and it'll still do good things for you. Finally, number eight, what three words would you most hope people would use to describe you?
Oh, resilient, committed, loyal.
Resilient, committed, and loyal. I was going to say, you could say chill and then just work yourself towards being the kind of person that others would describe as chill. I don't think that's going to happen for you, though, based on this conversation.
Not anytime soon.
Not anytime soon. Well, keep up the good work. It is clearly working for you, and you're finding a great deal of success. I like watching you. Everybody likes watching you. So, you know, hopefully you'll stick around and you won't get that GM job so we can keep you here. Otherwise, I'll just, you know, get all the inside info from you and report it.
You got it.
Thanks so much, Lewis. Have a good one.
Appreciate it, sir. Thanks a lot.
Oh, and another thing.
This week's That's What She Read is just a super fascinating look at journalism behind the scenes, and an incredibly compelling video to go with the read. Regardless of your politics, regardless of what side you land on, this story by the Washington Post about a woman who came to them with accusations about Roy Moore that turned out to be lies, how they discovered that, how they took her down, and why she was allegedly a part of some sort of undercover sting operation to try to out the Washington Post as, you know, lying media, and instead it got flipped around on her, is just really fascinating. It's sad and depressing that there's people like this in the world willing to do things like this. So in that respect, it's a tough watch and a tough read. But at the same time, it is just an incredible look at the machinations behind the scene of vetting people, testing out their stories, And how people will try to show up at places and sell a fraudulent story for their own cause. The story is called "A Woman Approached the Post with a dramatic and false tale about Roy Moore. She appears to be part of an undercover sting operation." It's by Sean Boberg, Aaron C. Davis, and Alice Kreitz, and you can find it in the Washington Post. And like I said, it doesn't matter what side you fall on. Watching the video as this reporter tries to nail down the woman with the accusations on all of the lies she's told, a GoFundMe that they find, a job she claims she works at that they can't find, another job she was applying to that wants to out the media. I mean, it's like a TV show. It's like the craziest TV show plot you could come up with, and it's real. So check it out. Watch the video. It's the Washington Post. Thanks again for lasting about an hour with me.